Okay, 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Now, we left off in chapter 6 with this, and I want you to understand Paul is going to deal again with more of the same subject that he dealt with last week in chapter 6. He dealt with fornication, and as he dealt with fornication last week, as we preached on that subject, what we talked about is that fornication is a sin against your own body. And the problem with that is that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit. And so understand that even though it's a different subject, Paul is approaching a new part of the book now. I see a little bit of last week's message still lingering here as Paul leaves the subject of fornication in chapter 6, only to pick it up again in chapter 7. Now, what you'll see in chapter 7, he said, "Now concerning the things whereof ye wrote unto me." So he's obviously entering a new discussion, answering questions that the people have written to him. That letter has been lost. No one knows what questions the Corinthians asked. And so as we work our way through the 40 verses of this chapter, and actually even the rest of the book, we have answers, but we don't have the question. And so I told somebody, I was talking to Levi on the phone about a couple of Greek words. I called Levi and said, "Levi, am I correct? These Greek words, do they mean this, and are they saying that?" And Levi said, "Well, I don't know that that's all that they're saying, but yes, they could be saying that," and so forth. But I told Levi, I said, "This is like a big game of Jeopardy." Anybody ever watch Jeopardy? You know, they give you the answer, but then you have to guess the question. Anybody ever played Jeopardy? Do you ever watch Jeopardy and play that game? So what I want you to do is, as we go along here, we see answers. I want you to think, I wonder what the question might have been. Because if we had the question, it'd be a whole lot easier to understand the answer. But Paul has given us some material here that were answers at the time to questions that the Corinthians had. Now you have to remember that the Corinthians were three-fourths pagan people. Now they had a Jewish element in the church. As a matter of fact, even their Jewish element was not united. They had Jews that converted Jews that were Palestinian Jews, and they had converted Jews that were Grecian Jews. They had some converted Jews that were probably had been contemporaries with Jesus Christ. And they didn't even recognize the authority of any of the apostles, because they looked upon the disciples of Jesus Christ. If they were contemporaries of Jesus and they were converted priests and Pharisees and Sadducees, those people looked down on the apostles and they didn't recognize apostolic authority. That would have been the party that was of Christ, because they said, "Well, we were converts of Christ himself. We trusted Jesus and we were contemporaries with him. The disciples mean nothing to us." And so there were several dynamics at work in the church at Corinth. But you have to understand, the hugest part of the church at Corinth were converted pagans. And they brought a lot of pagan baggage with them, pagan philosophy. We've talked a lot in the last couple of weeks about the dualism, how they saw the body as evil and the spirit as good. And then because of that, they were able to say, "Well, what I do in the body doesn't affect my spirit." And because of that, you saw people that were perfectly comfortable about committing fornication on Saturday and going to church on Sunday and singing praises to God. They didn't even see that those two things conflicted because of their pagan philosophy. So you have to remember the background of the people here. One of the commentators that I read on this said that in answering these questions, Paul did some things. Number one, his responses were conditioned by his attitude, or by the attitude of the world toward women in that day. Now, you're going to see Paul say some things about women that might surprise you a bit in this chapter. But you have to understand, the way that women were viewed in that day was not with equality. You know what has allowed women to be equal in society anywhere in the world has been Christianity. Nothing has ever done for women what Christianity has done. And Paul himself told us there's no difference between Jews and Greeks, between bondsmen or freemen, and there's no difference between men and women. We all have to get saved the same way, and we all serve the Lord the same way. And so Christianity gave equality, but you'll see some things here where from the pagan world, they didn't see men and women as equal. They saw men superior, and women were, in many cases, like a piece of property. And so you have to remember that some of Paul's responses are conditioned by the attitude of the world, the contemporary world, toward women. Also, something else you have to take into consideration in this chapter is Paul says the time is short. And he talks about that a little bit later. We'll see one of the verses there where he talks about the time is short. Those people literally believed with the situation that the church was in that day and age, there was persecution, there was heartache, there was grief, there was trouble, there was affliction, life was hard. Those people believed Jesus was coming. And so the result of that, some of the answers that Paul gives are seasoned by the fact that Paul himself expected Jesus to come any day. And from that day to this, we have believed in the imminent return of Jesus Christ. But largely because the scripture says so and because the apostles looked for his coming. And then one of the principles that Paul teaches in this chapter is that whether you marry or whether you do not marry or whatever you do about marriage after you get saved, don't let it become a distraction. Your chiefest thing should be serving the Lord. Avoid distractions from service to the Lord. In some cases, marriage will distract somebody who could faithfully serve the Lord if he weren't married. In some cases, celibacy would distract one from serving the Lord because he's going to burn with passion and he has no outlet for it. But there's no hint in this chapter that conjugal relationships are wrong or sinful. You see, you have to remember this. The church at Corinth had some of the very beginning stages of Gnosticism at work. And Gnosticism taught the people that you were holier if you deprived your flesh of the physical satisfaction of marriage. That even in marriage, there were Gnostics that when they got saved, even though they were married, they would no longer engage in conjugal relationships because they saw that as carnal. And they saw it as wicked, and they saw it as less than holy. I want you to understand, Paul gives no indication that there's anything unholy about conjugal relationships. There's no hint of that. His recommendations, and he does recommend celibacy, but his recommendation is simply based on his own authority, and he tells us that in this book. He does reinforce the indissolubility of marriage. He shows us here in this chapter, and we'll see it a little bit later, that if one person in the marriage feels that they need out, he said, if an unbeliever departs, then let him depart. But they have really two options. They either can remain unmarried or they can reconcile with their spouse. And those are the two options that Paul leaves there. So he reinforces the indissolubility of marriage. So, as I said, it would be wonderful if we had these questions, but we do not have the questions, so we're just going to have to look at the answers and guess what the questions may have been. So, with that being said, and with that little bit of introduction, let's start through this book and see what we find. Now, concerning the things whereof ye wrote me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Now, as I have studied that, and I'm not finished studying it yet, but as I've studied it, some of the commentators just launch right out and say, well, that's talking about the physical conjugal relationship of marriage. In other words, one guy even changed it. He said it's better to be celibate than to be married. But that isn't even what the word means. This word touch is an interesting word. Whatever the question is, the answer was, it's good for a man not to touch a woman. Now, what might the question have been? did they ask a question about marriage? Did they ask a question about fornication? What did they ask? You know, you have to understand, many of the Jews, Well, all of the Jews had been taught that it is right to be married. As a matter of fact, it was a rabbinical rule that you got married by 20 years old if you were a man. If you didn't get married by the age of 20, there was something wrong with you. And that was Jewish law. And it was rabbinical. You don't find it in Moses' law, but it was the rabbi's take on things. As a matter of fact, some of the rabbis taught that if you don't get married and produce children, you're as bad as a murderer. The fact that you didn't produce and bring into the world new life is the same as if you took it. You say, wow, that's out there. It is. But you have to understand, some of those people were in this church saying, married by the age of 20 or you're not right with God. Those were the Jewish converts. But you have to understand, from the Gentile converts, many of them were not married because of their dualistic philosophy. And you see, they didn't have to worry about their physical and emotional outlets for passion, because before they got saved, they could go up to the temple of Aphrodite and make sacrifices. And in so doing, they satisfied that without being bound in marriage. Does that make sense to you? Now, I find that a ludicrous kind of society, but that's the way the pagan world was. In other words, they did not have to get married to have conjugal relief. And so you got these two groups of people coming from two different backgrounds that, I mean, are 180 degrees apart, and they're all going to church together. Now, how do you figure that? Wouldn't you have loved to have been the pastor there? As a matter of fact, Levi pointed this out to me in his study of 1 Corinthians. He said there is no mention, and I confirmed this by several other authors, there's no mention of any pastors or deacons in the church at Corinth. There was no leadership there. That might be one reason that the party spirit ran wild like it did, because there was no leadership there. But you had these people coming from these different backgrounds. So was this a pagan that asked this question? And what did he mean by touch? Did he mean to marry? Because there are some people that say that's what the word means. Frankly, I didn't learn that myself. As I looked up the word, here's what the word means. It means... It has a stronger meaning than the other word for touch. There is a word for like just touching. That word is thaganao, and it means merely the sense of touch. It is indifferent touch. It's like you brushed somebody in the hallway as you walked past them. You touched them, but it wasn't on purpose. You touched them, there was no influence either given or taken by it. It's just like you bumped into somebody. Excuse me, and you go on. That's the word thaganao. But that's not the word that was used here. The word that was used here is the word hoptomai, and the form of it is the word hoptesthai. And it's a stronger meaning. It means handling beyond a mere touch. It means handling an object or a person to exert influence upon it or to be influenced by it. This is the same meaning. If you go back for a minute to Matthew chapter 8 and verse 3, very same word. Matthew chapter 8 and verse 3. Go back there for just a moment. Matthew chapter 8, verse 3. We'll actually start in verse 2. And behold, there came a leper and worshipped him, saying, Lord, if thou wilt, thou can make me clean. And Jesus put forth his hand and touched him. Same word. And said, I will, be thou clean. And immediately the leprosy was cleansed. Then the same word is used in verse 15 of the same chapter, talking about Peter's mother-in-law. Jesus went to Peter's house. He saw his wife's mother laid and sick with a fever. And verse 15, and he touched her hand, and the fever left her, and she arose and ministered unto them. And then in chapter 9, Matthew chapter 9 and verse 20, same word. Behold, a woman which was diseased with an issue of blood 12 years came behind him and touched the hem of his garment, same word. Chapter 9 and verse 29. And this was dealing with a blind man, and he touched their eyes, or two blind men. that came to Jesus, they were blind. They came to be healed. In verse 29, he touched their eyes, saying, according to your faith, be it unto you, and their eyes were opened. So this is a more than just a casual touch. It's more than just bumping into somebody indifferently. It would be an actual touch to influence or to be influenced to cause something to take place. Now, a secondary meaning, you might be interested in this, a secondary meaning means to kindle or to set on fire. And so in other words, this touch inflamed. Do you remember a passage back in the book of Proverbs where Solomon wrote about a man who was with a strange woman and committing sin with a strange woman? He said it's like taking a coal of fire into your bosom. Do you remember that? What's going to happen if you take a... Did you ever barbecue the old way when you had the old gray... The black coals? How many remember those days before you had the gas grills and you had to go get the black coals and spray some starter on it and then light it and jump back and light it again and jump back and spray some more on it and light it again and jump back. And finally they get to go on, and after they've burnt for a while, they begin to turn, the black ones turn gray. Well, what do you think is going to happen if you take the tongs and take one of those gray coals, and if you brush the gray away, what color is it? Red hot. I mean, it's an ember. And you just take it and put it in your pocket. What do you think is going to happen? How long do you think it's going to stay there? Think you're going to keep that covered up? You're going to hide that anywhere? Well, that's what Solomon said it's like when you commit transgression with a strange woman. You take it into your bosom and you think, man, I'll keep this secret. Nobody will know about it, but it's going to burn a hole in your pocket. You know, I remember when I was a kid, I used to get my allowance and I just begged to go to town. Mother'd say, yeah, your money's just burning a hole in your pocket, ain't it? And how many of you ever had some money like that? It was just burning a hole in your pocket. You just had to find some place to spend it. Didn't even matter if it was anything you really wanted. You just had to. But anyway, but taking a coal in your pocket is like that. Well, this word is something like that. This a secondary meaning of this word is to kindle or to set on fire, as though there was a coal that was burning away. So I want you to understand, I think there can be some layers of meaning. Now go back with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 7 when Paul says it's good for a man not to touch a woman. Now we're going to look at the context in a minute, and I want you to understand, I think it could be talking about conjugal relationships here. I think it could be saying that. I haven't satisfied my mind. My study level is not deep enough yet that I've made up my mind if I think that's what it's talking about. But I want you to understand that for years I have seen in this verse the danger of young people having physical relationships with each other that even appear to be casual to most people. But there's fires that get lit in bosoms by touching. One of the reasons that I always caution my kids, I don't want you holding hands. As teenagers, I don't want you doing that. And Elsie and I hold hands. We're married. Okay? Lots of husbands and wives here hold hands. I see you sometimes walking across the parking lot. And sometimes I'm really disappointed because you're walking miles apart. But I really love it when I look out there and I see a couple walking across the parking lot holding hands. You watch. A bunch of you will be showing off for me today. You get ready to go. You'll be out there holding hands and walking across the parking lot arm in arm. Well, I hope you do. I hope you do. You ought to love her, especially today if the sidewalk's slick. Get a hold of her good. But you know, when a guy who's not married to a girl reaches out and touches her hand, it not only is he influenced by that, but she is influenced by that as well. He's actually making her a little bit of a promise. I remember a counselor one day said that this guy broke up with this girl, and she fell all apart at the seams. This was in Bible college. She fell all apart at the seams. And she came into the professor's office and she said, he loved me. I know he loved me, and he's broken up with me, but he told me he didn't ever care for me. And he said, why did you think he loved you? She said, well, he held my hand. Guys, you have no idea what you're saying to a girl when you take her by the hand. You say, well, that's a simple, harmless thing. I didn't mean nothing by it. You might not have meant nothing by it, but you'd better understand things like that get interpreted lots of different ways by lots of different people. And what Paul is telling us here is we need to be careful about that kind of contact. I know of a preacher in North Carolina that was asked to resign his church because he couldn't keep his hands off the women folk. And you know what? I think the deacons were right to ask him to resign. I mean, it wasn't like they didn't go through proper channels. The deacons came to him and said, "You make our wives terribly uncomfortable, and you feel like you have to hug each lady." He said, "Well, I'm a hugging guy." He said, "But our wives don't want to be hugged." And you would think a guy with a half of a brain, as Rush Limbaugh would say, with half of his brain tied behind his back, you'd think a guy would get the idea, "I'd better keep my hands off the lady folks. They're watching me." But you know what? He refused. And he continued to hug the ladies. And he'd continue. He'd walk up and put his arm around them and put his hand on their shoulder. And it made many of them terribly uncomfortable. And I mean, it wasn't like he was asked once. He was asked a couple of different times. And finally, the men said, "You know what? You're going to have to resign. You're going to have to go. We can't have that." It is sending the wrong signal. Listen, when ladies come to the altar, I have my hand way out here. You're not going to see me reaching down, putting my arm around a bunch of ladies. Now, you know, I can say this. I'm nearly 60 years old, so I can do some things now that I couldn't do when I was 30. But I want you to understand, when I was 30, Brother Hiles always said this. He said, like in his 30s, he said I wouldn't touch any lady or kiss any lady on the cheek or whatever if she was under 6 or over 60. He said, then I would you know, touch the lady by, you know, maybe giving her a hug or something like that, under 6 or over 60. But he said, now that I'm almost 60, he said, these 60 years old are looking better all the time. And so he said, I might have to go from 7 to 70. but I want you to understand, you know, many churches have had difficulties with impurity in the ministry. Pastors and church leaders, youth directors, have been caught in infidelity with ladies in the church. And this is where it starts, with a touch. With a touch. And so, ladies, if I am a little standoffish, it isn't because I don't like you. It isn't that you get bad breath or anything like that. I'm not a hugger by nature, okay? Now, Elsie's family's all huggers. I kind of don't like going there. I love her family, but I wish they'd keep their distance. But, you know, all of the sisters-in-law have got to have a hug. Everybody's got to have a hug. It's North Carolina. Everybody's got to have a hug. And so I go, you know, but I'm not a hugger by nature. I don't even like hugging. I like hugging Elsie. But you get past Elsie, I'm not a hugger. But you know what? It's just particularly not good, not constructive, not conducive to good relationships between men and women within the church. It's just not. And then when you take it down to teenagers, boys and girls that are just becoming, or just coming into that time of their life where they're beginning to learn what the other sex is. You know, girls are just beginning to figure out what guys are and what they're for, and the guys are just beginning to own up to the fact that they've been looking at girls for a long time. You know, guys will say, you know, in the sixth grade, they look at a girl and say, "Oh, she's got cooties." Well, don't kid yourself. They like girls. They just won't own up to it until they're about sophomores in high school. But, you know, young people haven't lived long enough at that age to understand consequences. I want you to understand an adult is going to understand something of the consequences that go along with behavior a lot better than a young person will. So I'm saying, young persons, be careful with your contact with the opposite sex. It can lead you to be putting a coal of fire in your bosom and you will get burned. And the sad thing is, it isn't just you that gets burned. When you get burned, you burn the person you touch too. You light them on fire too. And remember, both young people have families, dads and moms and grandpas and grandmas, and our hearts all break when we see a young person go by the wayside because of sin, because of fornication. So I want you to take well the lesson here. It could be talking about marriage. It may be talking about marriage. He may be talking about conjugal touching. He may be talking about that. But I see a lesson here that I think we need not to overlook. Now, let's move on quickly. Verse 2. Nevertheless, to avoid fornication. In the Greek, that is plural. I do not know why it is fornication singular here, but in the Greek it is nevertheless to avoid fornications. In other words, I guess repeated acts or more than one act. Nevertheless, to avoid fornications, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband. Now, that word own, husband, for ladies, when it talks about every woman having her own husband, it's the word idios. So that's the word from which we get the word idiot. So, ladies, it says every woman there should have her own idiot husband. I thought that was funny. Now, the funny thing is, the word for own wife is not idios. So the ladies aren't idiots. Now, you have to understand what the word idios means. It means peculiar to. It means peculiar to. In other words, each woman is to have a husband that is peculiar to her, not shared by any other woman. Okay? That's what the idea is saying. Doesn't mean that he's an idiot. He might drive like one, but it's not saying that. But it doesn't say that about the men. That's kind of funny because to me, I would think every husband should have a wife that is peculiar to him. But you have to remember, Paul is talking to a society here where women have been treated as property. And in many cases, many of these people have come out of polygamy. They've had more than one wife. The men have had more than one wife, but the women never had more than one husband. Does that make sense to you? And that's the reason it's worded a little bit that way. But what's he saying here? Back in chapter 6, what did Paul tell us to do to help us to not commit fornication? What did he teach us? What was the principle? Don't commit fornication because your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit. Okay? It will help you not to commit fornication if you remember that God's Holy Spirit lives in your body. Here he's telling you it'll help you not to commit fornication if every man has his own wife and every wife has her own husband. In other words, marriage is part of God's prevention for sin in the life or against sin in the life of individuals. So is there any way that Paul could be saying marriage is bad? Is there any way here that he could be saying that conjugal relationship is wicked? It appears to me to be contradictory to the whole passage for Paul to be preaching that. Paul is saying one of the best things you can do to keep from committing fornication is to find a good woman or to find a good man and get married. I bet some of those Jewish people were saying, yeah, that's right, that's good preaching, Paul. Because they believed you had to be married by the age of 20 or you weren't any good. You see. And so, look a little further now. Let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence, and likewise also the wife unto the husband. Now, it's kind of veiled language here. He doesn't actually say that let the husband physically love his wife and let the wife physically love her husband. He doesn't use the word conjugal relationship here. He doesn't use any of that. It's kind of veiled. Let him render due benevolence to her. What's he mean by that? He's talking the act of marriage, my friend. And he shows us in the next verse, the wife hath not power of her own body, but the husband. And likewise also the husband hath not power of his own body, but the wife. You know what that's saying? My wife's body is mine, and my body is hers. And there's nothing dirty. There's nothing immoral. There's nothing wicked. There's nothing lustful. There's nothing lewd that takes place between a husband and wife. When a husband and wife conjugally love each other, physically love each other, there's nothing unclean about that at all. As a matter of fact, it was God's plan to prevent us from committing fornication. You see, and here's what you have to understand, between a husband and wife, there's a covenant. There's a commitment. And inside that covenant and that commitment, there is safety. And that was part of God's plan for us to not just wander through life in sin aimlessly, as many of the Greeks did. Now, you have to understand, this is not new teaching to the Jews that were in the church, but this is brand new teaching to some of the pagans that were in the church. Some of the people that had gotten saved out of pagan Aphrodite worship, they could not begin to imagine what Paul was talking about. And many of them had skewed thoughts, either that physical love was dirty or immoral, even between a husband and wife, or some of them had an excessive amount of liberty that, they'd been used to going to the temple of Aphrodite and committing all kinds of fornication, and it was not a problem. Some of them didn't see it as a problem. Others said, man, you'd be better off, the body is evil, you'd be better off to be a celibate. I want you to understand, Paul's dealing with some really wild differences of opinion here. Notice verse 5. He says, defraud ye not one another. What's he mean by that? When a husband and wife marries, there are some expectations that you have every right to have. Okay? When we get married, when Elsie and I got married, I had every right to expect that she was going to cook my meals. I had every right to expect that she'd do my laundry. I had every right to expect that she'd keep the house clean. I had every right to expect that she would bear my children. I had every right to expect that she would love me physically. And she had every right to expect that I'd bring home my paycheck. She had every right to expect that I would not cheat on her with another woman. She had every right to expect that I would love her physically, and that after bringing those children into the world, that I would help raise them. She had every right to expect that. And when you do not complete your end of the bargain, Paul calls that defrauding. Very specifically here in the context of this chapter, he's saying that if a wife doesn't love her husband physically, she has defrauded him. And if a husband doesn't love his wife physically and faithfully with fidelity, he has defrauded her. Defraud ye not one another. Don't cheat each other out of conjugal love, out of conjugal relationship. Don't do that. And then he goes ahead and gives an exception. Except it be with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer. Are there times where husbands and wives should fast from a conjugal relationship? Absolutely. I think there's times that, we get the idea that Joe loves to fast. Okay, Joe loves to fast. You fast often. I would probably do myself real good to fast more often than I do, which is about once every 5 or 6 years. I don't fast very often. I should fast more. But you know what? The problem is if you think fasting is just food. You know what? It'd do you good. It'd do you good to fast from television for a while. It'd do you good to fast from listening to the political junk for a while. I have to confess, I'm probably too ignorant, but I have to say that some of you folks worry me. You've watched every word that's come out of every politician's mouth, and you still don't know who you like. You know, it's because all their words are veiled and you don't really know what anybody's saying anyway, for sure. You don't really know what anybody's going to do till he gets elected, and then it's all different than what they said in the campaign. I really sound like a cynic here, don't I? And I'm working on Brother Fox. I'm trying to get him to be a little more cynical than he is too. But you have to understand that, I forget what it was I was going to tell you now. I got to talking about politics and, fasting. Some folks need to fast from the television. Some folks need to fast from news. I know folks that are so worked up over how bad a condition the world is in and how bad a condition the finances are in that they can't sleep at night. They're so upset. You know what? You do yourself a favor, turn that off once in a while. It's not going to change anything about the way you live anyway. There's a lot of things that involve fasting besides just not eating food. And one of the things that sometimes we need to do is fast from conjugal relationship. You remember Jesus told, the Lord told Moses before they gathered around Mount Sinai, I'm going to come and visit you, and I think it was in 3 days. And he told Moses, tell the men not to come at your wives. What do you think he meant? Fast from the conjugal relationship. When David ate the bread that was in the table of that came off the table of showbread, remember when he went down to the city of Nob and he was running from Saul and he took the showbread and the priest said, "What about it? Have any of you guys been with women?" And David said, "Nope, we haven't been with women for 3 days." He said, "Okay, you can have the bread." The idea is fasting from the conjugal relationship is another kind of fasting. And Paul said, you know what? Your spiritual walk's more important than your carnal walk or your walk in this flesh. Walking with God's more important than walking with your wife. Walking with God's more important than walking with your husband. And there might come a time where you need to, as husband and wife, you need to just say, you know, I just need to fast and pray for 2 or 3 days. But notice the warning he gives here. He said, and come together again that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency. In other words, if you separate yourself from your spouse too long physically, you can actually bring temptation upon yourself or upon your spouse. And so Paul has given some principles here by which to live, but what I want you to see is he's very clear. There's nothing wrong with a physical relationship. And yet I find sometimes that there are people that enter into marriage with the idea that, you know what, there's just something nasty about that. Sometimes mothers will teach their daughters that it's a nasty thing. And sometimes people have even been raised in churches where they were taught that it's okay as far as reproduction is concerned, but it's not for pleasure and enjoyment. Well, that's funny. Solomon told his son, he said, rejoice in the wife of thy youth. Let her be as a young hind to thee. And Solomon went in Proverbs and built a beautiful picture of physical love between a husband and a wife. And it was a beautiful thing. It was nothing nasty or dirty about it at all. And yet the world will take everything that God has made and try to twist it and turn it and defile it and ruin it any way they can. Either they'll take God's teachings to an excess and say, you know, let's just commit fornication, live any way we want to, let's just exercise free love. Or they'll say physical love is dirty. Either way, God is not glorified. God is glorified when we follow His plan. One man, woman, and one woman, man, and a husband and a wife love each other and commit each other and commit themselves to each other until death do us part. And that's God's plan. And so with all that being said, we see here that Paul is, whatever question had been asked in verse 1 that he answered there, it's good for a man not to touch a woman. Look at the context. Look at the context. Do you think Paul was saying it's good for a man not to ever marry? Do you think that's what he was saying there? I just have a hard time seeing that. It appears to me as though there was a different question that was asked. And Paul answered that question carefully, but then he was very careful to qualify that between a husband and a wife, there is no sin in conjugal relationship. As a matter of fact, it is God's defense against fornication in the life of a man and woman. Now look at verse 6. But I speak this by permission and not by commandment. Now, I've seen some guys that, a couple of commentators that I think their eyes are set a little too close together. Couple of commentators said that that this isn't inspired because Paul said, I speak this, not the Lord. You know, this is me talking here. I speak this by permission and not by commandment. What Paul is meaning is that there is no hard and fast rule for anybody here. Later on, he's going to tell us if you have the gift to live without a woman, you can actually serve God better if you have the gift. What he's saying is that there's not a hard and fast commandment either way. God has made us to be individuals. What'll work for some people won't work for others. Some men could live without a woman. Some women can go to the mission field and live without a man. But there's other people that would burn and fall into sin if they did that. You understand? It is not that the Holy Spirit wasn't telling Paul what to write here. But what Paul is doing is Paul is saying, look, you're going to have to figure out who you are and who God has meant you to be. There are some things here. Were you meant to live as a eunuch? Or were you meant to be a married man? Which is it that God meant for you? He goes ahead and he said, for I would that all men were even as myself. But every man hath his proper gift of God, one after this manner and another after that. What does Paul mean when he says, I wish that all men were as myself? Well, what he's talking about is Paul was a single guy. And Levi and I were talking about this week as I was driving to Des Moines. I talked with him for about an hour on my phone and as I drove along. And Levi and I have both heard the same thing all of our lives. We've heard that Paul was a member of the Sanhedrin. And you had to be married to be a member of the Sanhedrin. So the question is, what happened to Paul's wife? Did she leave him when he became a Christian? Or was she dead? Was he a widower? I don't know. And the thought occurred to me, you know, I've never seen any place that said Paul was a member of the Sanhedrin. Has anybody ever seen that? I've never seen that. The more I get to thinking about it, the more I get to thinking, you know, I don't know that Paul was married. I don't know that he was. Later on in one of the passages in Corinth, he says, I have the right to take about a wife like Peter does, but I choose not to do it. So if Paul had a right to be married, I have a hard time believing that he was a divorcee, that his wife had left him. And there's no mention that he was a widower. If he was a widower, she died pretty early because Paul was 30 or so when he got saved. And he was single then. Paul's point is, I wish that all of you were single like me. You know what he's going to tell us later? Being married's a lot of work. How many of you figured that out? Being married's a lot of work. And anybody that tells you that two can live as cheap as one, they hadn't done the arithmetic. Two cannot live as cheap as one. And you can't live on love. I found out they don't take love at Walmart. You go in to buy groceries, they want hard cash or plastic. But they don't want love. I want you to understand being married is a lot of work. And you know what? It takes time. It takes time. And then with marriage, you know, first comes love, then comes marriage, then comes David with a baby carriage, you know. And so, you know, you get married and you fall in love and then you have children. And now it takes a lot of work. Raising kids is hard work. What Paul is saying, I would that you were like me. I don't have a wife to mess with. I don't have kids to mess with. I don't have diapers to change. I don't have college tuition to pay. And because of that, I can give my whole life to God. But you know what? Not everybody can live that way. The point Paul is making is figure out who you are. Do what God wants you to do. Isn't it good that God let us all be individuals and we don't have to wear little uniforms and all of us walk around being just like everybody else? But God let us be individuals here. And so then we see, he said, I would that all men were even as myself, but every man hath not his proper gift. hath his proper gift of God, one after this manner and another after that. Remember in Matthew chapter 19, verse 11, Jesus said, there are some men that are eunuchs. They were made eunuchs. I'm trying to remember exactly how Jesus said that. Let's turn there real quick. And I'm going to quit here pretty quick. I've used up my time. I'm just kind of working my way through this passage and thinking my way through it with you. Matthew chapter 19, verse 11. He said, all men cannot receive this saying, save they to whom it is given. For there are some eunuchs which were born from the mother's womb. And there are some eunuchs which were made eunuchs of men. And there be eunuchs which have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. But not everybody has that gift. Notice, he that is able to receive it, let him receive it, Jesus said. There's people that can live that way and people that can't. And later, Paul is going to tell us it's better to marry than to burn. Burning in lust is no way to live. And so God's protection for that is to find a good wife or find a good husband and be married. So we're going to draw that to a conclusion there, I think, today. Matter of fact, notice verse 8 and verse 9. I just quoted that, so we'll read that and then we'll quit. I say, therefore, to the unmarried and widows, it is good for them if they abide even as I, that is, unmarried, if you can do that. But if they cannot contain, let them marry, for it's better to marry than to burn. I want you to understand, Paul is not diminishing the marriage relationship at all. As a matter of fact, it appears to me that he promotes it as a good way to avoid fornications. But we need to understand that if we're going to be married, there's responsibilities there. It's the husband's responsibility to love his wife. It's the wife's responsibility to respect her husband. And so when we choose to marry, let us be sure that we do not defraud one another by not fulfilling our responsibilities, whether they be physical responsibilities or emotional or financial, whatever those responsibilities are, we want not to defraud our spouse. Would you bow with me, please, for prayer?